Welcome. This is Christopher Holmes, and this is Zero Point Radio Show. And I today am calling from Auckland, New Zealand. I have been attending the Theosophical Society Conference in Auckland on Theosophy and Science. And I gave a lecture yesterday based on my work on God, Science, and the Secret Doctrine, which is the title of my newest book, Exploring the Work of H.P. Blavatsky. And I give two more talks today, and we'll be in New Zealand for at least another week. And in the background here, I have James Moffat. Jim, hi. Hello, how are you?
I'm good. Are you having any problems hearing me in terms of the time delay?
No, I'm not, Jim. You're coming in very clear.
I guess the satellites have rectified that problem. I did a study of that many years ago about the effects of time delay on communications and telephones, but I don't think it exists anymore with satellites.
It's remarkable. Here I am in New Zealand and doing this show out of California.
halfway around the globe, eh?
Yeah, and then it's available around the world.
It's quite a remarkable
modern phenomena.
Extraordinary age we live in terms of the possibilities for communication, technologically anyway.
Yeah.
The other aspects of it, but
I had planned on trying to run the show from New Zealand today, but it really doesn't work, and there are some talks I don't want to miss, and I've been a big part of the conference here. Beautiful center, the Theosophical Society in New Zealand has a beautiful headquarters here and facility here. It's been an exciting conference, and we are just going into the second day. So I'll give a longer report on the conference in 2 weeks' time on our next show.
Yeah, how long has there been a Theosophical Society in New Zealand, do you know?
I'm not sure. Just a minute. Murray, how long has there been a Theosophical Society in New Zealand? Yeah. 110 years.
Wow.
It's quite remarkable, actually. There's about 12 theosophy lodges in New Zealand. It's funny how they're much more active than what I've seen of the TS in Canada, and I don't know the situation in the States as much, but I'm really very impressed.
Yeah.
What a beautiful facility here. And they have, you know, the symbol that Blavatsky is associated with theosophy, the circle with the snake swallowing its own tail, and it has the Star of David, and it has an ankh in it, and it has a swastika reversed the opposite way from the Nazi one. That symbol of theosophy is so beautiful here. They have it all over the place in stained glass and carved in wood, and it's such a remarkable image and symbol. I spent time the other day in the library here, that beautiful library facilities with such a collection of early theosophical productions. So it's really been quite fun being here. And
what exactly, you've given one talk so far or more than one talk?
Sorry, I couldn't hear.
How many talks have you given? You've given one talk or one lecture?
I gave one yesterday, and I give two today. And my second talk today is going to focus on the concept of zero-point dynamics and explaining that and Blavatsky's concepts of space. So I explain how he talks about zero points in holographic space. So I'll be trying to... I began to elaborate upon that yesterday, but it has so much material that I'm going to pick up on it today and explain it more thoroughly today. And then my second talk today is Mystical Views of Consciousness and the Heart, elaborating upon the heart doctrine and the nature of the monad, as Blavatsky calls it, the monad is like essentially the God spark within the human being. So Blavatsky really has very profound concept of how we all have these monadic essences which are established in higher dimensional space, which he calls the eternal parent space. And these monads is like the God spark within the human being. So that'll be the focus, looking at on zero points and then the study of monads. Okay. So what has you have planned for today, Jim?
Oh, I don't know.
You had said that you were going to try to give an overview a bit of my life's work. And
I mean,
you, more than anybody, has followed and contributed to my work for the last 30 years.
Yeah, and
I understand you are going to try to review some of the developments and phases of my work. And
yeah, I thought
you've kind of seen the progression and development of my work and teaching through these 30 years. I don't think there's any more apt commentator on my work than yourself.
Yeah, well,
especially given your wide studies in science and mysticism and so on.
Yeah, I thought today that I would what I would do is I thought I would go right back to the beginning and talk about how when we were graduate students we got introduced to the fourth way, and it's quite an extraordinary journey in terms of. You know, 30 years is a long time to study anything, and it kind of testifies to the complexity and at the same time the wonder of all this that 30 years later we're still studying and there's so much more to study and to try to know. But ironically, I was cleaning out some drawers the other day and I found a paper that you wrote years and years ago when you were still a graduate student called Moot Points Within the Consciousness Literature, or maybe just after you'd gotten your PhD, and you're kind of talking about, just based on the Gurdjieff work in the fourth way perspective, what you saw as being kind of the governing assumptions in consciousness literature, which an esoteric perspective challenged, and you were kind of raising these questions as to, you know, what consciousness, excuse me, is and isn't, and what psychologists assume it to be. And it's funny because at the end you kind of just say, well, I'm raising these questions, you know, I don't have the answers to these things. And I think, well, 30 years later, you know, what an extraordinarily different perspective you would have on those moot points now. Like each of them has been
around. Really? Remarkable, eh? Because now, in a way, I feel I do have the answers. I know this is the truth.
That's what I was thinking.
But I have a whole comprehensive model consistent with the mystical literature that really, answers those moot points in a wholly different way than I understood 20, 30 years ago.
Yeah, and I'd say that, it's quite funny almost. Like when I read that, I started laughing. I'm thinking, well, I think he's got some of the answers now, but, I think one of the things that's really kind of extraordinarily exciting about all this is that I think even if you had some tentative answers, I don't think you would have ever have thought that you would be presenting a framework to answer these questions, which essentially...
I can't hear quite. Are you speaking directly into the phone?
Yeah. Is that better?
Okay.
I'll try a little louder. I'm not sure. No, I was just saying that, I think that in trying to answer those questions, I doubt that you would have thought that you would, you would have come to a perspective which involves such profound cosmological ideas as well as psychological ideas.
Yeah, as what I came to over time. No, I would have had no idea. It would have been so beyond me at that time to have conceived such a understanding as I have gained through my life.
It's interesting too, because having said that, can you hear me all right?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, you're very faint.
Oh, okay. I'll try to speak a little louder then. So, I hope I'm not shouting to our listeners, but it's funny because the germ was there, the seed was there from the Gurdjieff work, in that he says, that really the study of psychology and the study of cosmology are the division between the two is really an artifact in a sense, and that in essence they're unified on a higher level of integration and knowledge these things are unified, and you can't study one without studying the other. And so, like, we knew that on some level, you knew that on some level, but it was just, it was a germ, it was a seed, eh? And now it's so fully developed compared to, you know, 30 years ago. It's quite extraordinary.
Yeah, it's a real model now.
Yeah.
I remember one of the early shocks to me was reading that account by Yogananda of his experience of cosmic consciousness.
Yes.
In Autobiography of a Yogi. And I remember he depicts how his consciousness expanded to these different levels till ultimately he essentially experienced cosmic consciousness and experiencing the universe within himself. And then all of a sudden the consciousness came back into his body, and he said, I realized that there was a point of intuitive perception within my heart had somehow embraced the whole of the universe. And I remember at the time, like, wow, what a shocking, shocking description, and wondering, like, is he just imagining this, or could this actually be true? And if it was true, what could possibly be the scientific basis for such expanded states of higher consciousness? And now, in my work, I can see the basis of that. I can understand the physics of that in terms of zero-point dynamics and concepts of holographic space. So it's like that was an early marker for me a little bit, like when I understood his description of those elevated states.
Yeah.
And then wanting to strive to understand how such things might be possible, and not just dismissing that such possibilities out of hand, but taking it seriously.
Yeah, and
I think you were impacted in the same way by when I drew your attention to that description by Yogananda and started incorporating it into my writings.
Yeah, but even that, you know, it's funny because I had read that book. I think I'd actually read that book and recommended it to you, and then you read it, and then you were giving a lecture about consciousness, and you were talking about consciousness and light, and one of your students came up and reminded you of that material in Yogananda, and you said you went back to it, and you hadn't kind of grasped it the first time, you know? And then,
yeah, that's exactly right. I remember that. Yeah. I remember it was the attractive Oriental student at the time at York University who was doing a special studies with me. And she brought it to my attention. And I, as you say, I'd read the book, and I hadn't grasped it at the time, like the significance of it.
And even, you know, even then, and then, you know, and then you kind of started expanding on it and talking about, well, you know, if this is true, what does this mean and how could we understand it? But even when you presented it that way, and then I took that and I started developing it that in my own writing, and I referred to it and connected it with other material on the idea of consciousness as light. But even then, like the idea of the intuitive point of perception in my heart, I don't even think at that point, like, you hadn't really started to articulate the heart doctrine. And so then later, you started developing more and more this idea that consciousness originates in the heart, and that the heart is the source of light which illuminates the psychic functions. And you hadn't actually developed that idea at that point. And then I think...
Yeah, no, I hadn't really grasped the significance of that. It took years to really comprehend, like, wow, this is what the mystics are saying, that our true self is connected to the heart, or as I describe it now, the higher dimensional physics of the human heart. So it's funny how we can know these things, but it's only over many years that knowledge really deepens and deepens until we really grasp even those things that we ourselves are teaching.
Yeah, and as I say, you know, it was kind of like a dialectic there between the two of us in some sense, and that, you know, well, especially for me, I think the thing that really struck me was when you started to develop the heart doctrine, and then I realized, like, you know, when you're talking about the difference between the Jivatma and the super soul, that the Paramatma, Paramatma, like between the individual soul and the super soul, and that somehow the super soul is within the heart, and the soul is in within the heart, and also the super soul is in within the heart, but we don't kind of make that connection between the individual soul and the super soul until we develop the capacity to know ourselves in that very deep and profound sense, and like that whole idea of that there's an intuitive point in our heart which connects us to the cosmos, of course, is directly related to the idea of the zero point, which I think is one of the most unique and fascinating aspects of your work, is that you've taken that idea not only to refer to different world orders, that things come out of zero points, but that we originate from zero points.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. I don't know.
It's interesting because even today I find in the literature, although the ideas about zero point fields and so on are quite contemporary and gaining recognition, I don't know any other modern theorist who's arguing that a human being actually has a zero point center themselves. Even in the modern consciousness literature, I think I'm alone in arguing that.
Yeah, and I don't think, I don't really think anybody, it's funny because even people who adhere to an esoteric perspective or who definitely articulate that and incorporate that in their ideas, they still talk about the brain as if the brain somehow produces consciousness, and there's not that recognition of the heart doctrine, and I think that's the other part of things in your work which is really quite unique. I don't really know of anybody who really addresses that.
Yeah, no, nor do I. Not who gives it the same emphasis.
Yeah,
and it's funny because what I am teaching is so consistent with many other sources, and I think many people on learning what I teach and articulate would confirm it. Like, it's consistent with what they themselves have experienced or studied, but never quite put together in the same way.
Well, I know, it took place over the course of several years, but I know that when you were writing about the heart doctrine and you were trying to develop this material, I remember reading your manuscripts and being like kind of really shocked by how consistent through so many different teachings this idea that consciousness originates in the heart, and that people don't mean this metaphorically, they actually mean this literally, how consistent that appears. To the point where, like I was kind of telling you at times, it's like you have too many quotations from too many people saying the same thing. You know, like it's so obvious when you read it, that when you really look at it with an open mind, that this is in all of the esoteric and mystical literature. Eh?
Yeah, I think that is partly how my work is so important, especially the Heart Doctrine book, where I explain the Heart Doctrine as drawn from Judaism and Kabbalah, Christianity, Sufism and Islam, the Dalai Lama and Tibetan Buddhism, the secret doctrine. Like, as you say, it's in Sufism, all these different sources. And when it's articulated, then you begin to see it. Like, you begin to, it kind of draws things together in a unique way. I think my work's very valuable in opening up an understanding of the mystical esoteric literature to people. Like, it provides certain keys which are so invaluable.
Yes, yeah. And also, at the same time, in terms of the dialogue that, you know, you're trying to establish with modern science and psychology, the whole idea of the nature of consciousness, I mean, everybody assumes pretty much in consciousness research that the brain produces consciousness, and yet, as you point out, and as Stanislav Grof says, you know, this is one of the fundamental epistemological assumptions, ontological assumptions in modern science and psychology, and yet that's all it is. It's an assumption. Nobody's actually been able to prove this or been able to document. They just say, consciousness is generated by the brain, whereas the whole mystical esoteric tradition draws the analogy between the sun and the moon, and that the sun originates in the heart, the light originates in the heart, and it illuminates the mind in the brain, so that the brain is akin to the moon, and the sun is akin to the heart is akin to the sun, and that is very, very, very radically different idea about the nature of what we are as beings and how we're aware of ourselves as human beings. I mean, it has such profound implications.
Yeah. Okay, I'm already a little bit late for the first lecture this morning.
Okay.
So, well, thanks for carrying today's show, Jim. And
okay.
I don't know, you didn't have any guests or anyone planned to help you out with the show?
Well, I tried to contact Karen, but I haven't been able to get a hold of her, although I didn't really kind of know that I was going to, you know, have her as a guest. I thought actually that was a miscommunication, because I thought that you had mentioned this to her already. But I tried to contact her today, and Don tried her too, and we haven't been able to get a hold of her. But if she's listening...
Yeah, we might. If you want to draw Karen in at one point, you might ask Don to call my usual home number,
okay,
and she may be there. She's likely even listening at the moment, or she might be able to call in on the guest line, or you might want to open it up to other guests at some point.
Yeah. Well, we tried to.
I would expect, knowing Karen, that she's likely there somewhere listening, and she, you know, she knows me personally best over the last 10 years, so can provide, you know, a different perspective and. Less on the intellectual side, even.
Sorry, I missed a little bit of that because Don is trying to contact Karen. We tried earlier, but we couldn't get a hold of it. But if she's listening, answer the phone because
Okay. So, well, I hope it goes well. You also have the opportunity to open up the phone lines and so thanks very much, Jim, and I'll be in contact with you, and I'll be back as a regular host in 2 weeks' time. Okay, thank you, Jim.
Okay, Chris, I sort of missed the last part of what you said because Don is using my line to try.
I can't quite hear, Jim. It's funny doing a show by yourself on the telephone. It's quite odd a little bit. Sometimes it just feels like you're talking to yourself. It really helps having someone who's a counterpart or foil or whatever. But anyway, thanks very much, Jim.
I kind of found that out the hard way the last show, Chris, because at the end I kind of lost my track because I didn't have much time, and at the same time I wanted to say a few things, but it was very difficult, and I thought, oh, please get me out of here. I'm ready to eject it, because it is a little bit odd. You're just sort of talking to yourself.
Yeah, just talking to the phone, yeah.
It's a conversation.
Yeah.
Anybody listening?
Okay, well, thanks, and thanks, BBS, and this is Zero Point Radio. I'll be back in 2 weeks, and this is James Moffitt chairing the show today. Thanks, James. Thanks, Don.
Okay, have
Goodbye.
A good time, Chris. Well, that was Christopher Holmes, live from New Zealand, and this is Zero Point Radio, James Moffitt sitting in for Christopher, and Christopher will be back in 2 weeks. I don't know if he's actually going to be back in North America, but I assume he's coming back, and we're trying to hook up with Karen Hale, and Karen, if you're actually listening to the show, maybe you could call in, I think the... direct line is open now. It's 530-876-3222. And I thought today that Christopher and I were talking about this extraordinary voyage that we've taken over the last 30 years together in terms of studying esoteric and mystical teachings, and how, as I say, I came across a paper that he had written 25, 30 years ago about the nature of consciousness, and he was asking questions at that point. And in the ensuing 25 to 30 years, I think he's developed what is really quite an extraordinary model of consciousness, really quite unparalleled in modern thought, one which draws on both esoteric and mystical teachings and integrates them with psychological ideas from modern psychology, as well as ideas from modern science, particularly physics. Christopher has developed over the years an avid interest in physics, and I think in some ways that his understanding of mystical and esoteric teachings has really been moved forward by his interest in physics and what he's learned from physics, so that there's been a real dialogue for him between both the physical sciences and psychology and the mystical and esoteric psychology and cosmology. And so, in a sense, I think he's really quite a unique scholar in the way that he's been able to integrate this material and bring it together and consistently develop this model that he's developed of consciousness, which is both psychological in nature and cosmological in nature. So I wanted to go back to the very beginning, actually, because I'm currently writing a book about Christopher's work entitled The Problem of God's Contracting Universe, which deals with his reply to a statement that Carl Sagan made some 30 years ago in a lecture that he gave called A Sunday Sermon. That appears in Broca's Brain, his book, the subtitle of which is Reflections on the Romance of Science. And in that book, in that lecture, Carl Sagan said that he was talking about how science had discovered more and more explanations of various phenomena in which were natural explanations, scientific natural explanations. And as a result, he said that it seems that as science advances, there is less and less for God to do. And Christopher's response to this when he read this was to say, well, it was to ask, is this true? And, I mean, he didn't think that this was true, but he said, is this true? And how can we approach this question? And what he proposed to do was to try to articulate a series of replies to Dr. Sagan in terms of the esoteric and mystical literature and in terms of the psychological and cosmological model that he was developing. And so that was, I guess, about 1979 he began working on that material, and he actually started a book at one point called The Problem of God's Contracting Universe, but he didn't really end up publishing under that title. He changed the emphasis of his work and continued to try to develop his ideas, but he abandoned that title. But I think in a way that title is provides an overview of his entire corpus of work. He's published 7 books, and I would say that really all of them are addressed to the problem of God's contracting universe. He's trying to answer this question as how we might understand the nature of ourselves, the nature of the universe, and the nature of the gods in terms of an esoteric, mystical perspective on consciousness and the nature of human beings. And even though he's abandoned that title, I think that really captures the essence of Chris's work. He's trying to understand who we are and where we fit in this vast and incredibly complex and mysterious universe. And so I've been trying to provide an outline of his work. It's extremely complex, and it requires people to entertain a lot of ideas that they're not familiar with. So I realize that I've kind of bitten off more than I can chew, and that I'm really going to have to approach this in 2 or 3 volumes. But the first volume of my work is called The Problem of God's Contracting Universe, and I'm trying to present how Christopher came to these ideas and how he initially began to formulate them and how his ideas grew over several years and how that they, as we were discussing earlier, how his understanding of things became much, much more complex and profound. And I think that in part my purpose is just to present his ideas, is to present an overview of his ideas. But at the same time, one of the things that really strikes me that I find quite objectionable is that so many contemporary thinkers, and especially scientists, use the term mysticism in a pejorative sense, and by mysticism or mystics or anything that they equate with that, they kind of mean it in the sense that they use those terms in the sense that this is something that's insubstantial or vague or unproven or irrational or anti-intellectual, but they never really use the word mysticism in the real meaning of mysticism, which is union with God or union with the reality of the unity of creation. And so what I'm trying to do is to show that that to study mysticism and mystical and esoteric ideas is not exactly, it's not at all, Stephen Hawking, for instance, says it's a cop-out for those who just are intellectually inferior. But that's a completely absurd and idiotic representation of what mysticism is. Christopher Holmes and I have been studying this material from the mystical and esoteric tradition now for 30 years, and although we know some things and think we know some things and understand some things, we really just scratched the surface. I mean, I think Christopher would say that he hasn't scratched the surface, but that he's gone beyond that in a sense. But there are always so many more intriguing questions and intriguing matters to be pursued that this perspective presents to one. And so, in trying to trace the arc of his career, what I'm trying to suggest is that really that this is a continuous process of learning and a continuous process of increasingly complex elaboration and articulation of ideas that are incredibly profound and are not for people who are intellectually challenged or inferior. They're not irrational. In fact, they're comprehensive and they're lucid and they're elegant and they're quite profound. And in some senses, they lead to an understanding of the nature of reality which surpasses that which science presents. And so that's what my main purpose in Volume 1 is to contrast Christopher's ideas with those of Carl Sagan in particular as a representative of modern science. I would say that Sagan really espouses the dominant materialistic, reductionistic, mechanistic understanding of reality that science puts forth, and has popularized that view in his many works. And Christopher has drawn very radically different conclusions. And what I'm trying to suggest is that if we compare and contrast these ideas, it becomes quite clear that science does not have a monopoly on wisdom, and that science is not the only or necessarily the best way to come into contact with reality, to be able to know reality. excuse me, there's a, at the Delphic Oracle, there was an inscription engraved over the Oracle of Delphi, and it said that, "Man, know thyself, and thou wilt know the universe and the gods." And that is the basic, basically summarizes the epitome of the mystical and esoteric tradition. That could be the motto of those who seek after truth in terms of mystical and esoteric teachings, is that to know thyself is to know not only thyself, but the universe and the gods. And of course, by thyself, that doesn't refer to, you know, our usual superficial understanding of our little selves that go about in the world, but rather thyself in terms of the depth of the self which is connected with the universe and with the gods. And so really that's a very radically different epistemological viewpoint, a viewpoint on how we know, and a different ontological viewpoint, a viewpoint on the nature of being. And that's what Christopher has and I have been pursuing for the last 30 years, and that we've been trying to articulate in our writings. And I wanted to just mention, I don't think Chris mentioned this, he usually does at the beginning of the show, but if you go to www.zeropoint.ca, Christopher has a website there, and he has a lot of his writings, selections from his writings posted there, and he has a basic description of what his work's about, and he posts various commentaries on a variety of issues, some political and social issues of the day, as well as mystical and esoteric ideas and ideas about the nature of physics and metaphysics. And I would urge all of you listening to visit the site and familiarize yourself with his work and explore the site. I have a few things posted there. One piece from my book, An Alien Intelligence, which is about G.I. Gurdjieff and the Fourth Way. And I have a review that I wrote on Peter Washington's book, Madame Blavatsky's Baboon, which is published about the early 90s, I guess, in which he talks about the mediums, quote, and the misfits, unquote, that brought spiritualism to America, and he discusses the work of Gurdjieff and Madame Blavatsky, Rudolf Steiner, and Krishnamurti, and I have a critical review of his work there, and I try to expose what I think is decidedly biased and phony examination of these spiritual giants, because in a sense his work purports to examine the work of these teachers, but basically it's an ad hominem attack on Gurdjieff and Blavatsky especially, and to a lesser extent on Krishnamurti, although he's not very kind to him either, Krishnamurti and Steiner. But he's pretending to examine their teachings and their ideas, but he never really in any way addresses their teachings and deals with them in a substantive way. So what I'm suggesting is that really his whole book is, it's quite entertaining, but it's quite phony in the sense that you won't really learn anything essential about Blavatsky or Gurdjieff or any of the other figures that he covers. So I wanted to go back and, as I said, I wanted to go back to the very beginning, and I wanted to talk a little bit about how Christopher's work began. I've known Chris Holmes since 1967. We were in high school together, and he was quite a unique character even at that point. I think I started to really like this guy when he stood up in our English class to give a speech one day, and it began, "Hello, have you been bothered by LSD and your sugar cubes lately?" And then he proceeded to, this is 1967, he proceeded to give a very interesting discussion of the drug and its effects on the psyche, and I was quite amazed that anybody would have the nerve, first of all, to examine a somewhat controversial topic like that. But then, as I got to know him a little bit, I realized that he was already, you know, when he was 16, 17 years old, he already knew what he was going to do with his life. He was going to be a psychologist. He was going to be a psychotherapist. And what he was really interested in was the nature of the self and what it meant to be human. This is when he was 16 or 17. I think at the same time, I wanted to be a cowboy or perhaps a firefighter or, you know, maybe play center field or right field alongside Willie Mays in the San Francisco Giants outfield. So I was quite struck by the fact that this guy was obviously light years ahead of me in terms of knowing what he wanted to do with his life. And so Christopher and I attended Carleton University together in the late 60s, and he studied psychology and I studied sociology, and he graduated and went on to pursue his PhD at the University of Waterloo in Southern Ontario. He was doing this with the purpose of becoming a clinical psychologist. And I dropped out of school for a couple of years after I got my degree and worked for a couple of years, and then decided that, in large part from Chris's influence, that I was really wanted to go back and get my master's or PhD in psychology and perhaps work as a therapist or at least work in some sort of counseling and development area. And so I returned to school in 1975 and took an honors psychology and sociology, and then went on to start my master's at Carleton University in Ottawa while Chris was working on his PhD. And while Chris was working on his PhD, he had a real interest, as I say, he'd always been interested in the nature of self and in the nature of self-perception. And at the same time, he and I kind of had an interest in paranormal phenomena, and we had read a variety of material on these things, and were quite fascinated by the whole idea that there were faculties of human perception which didn't seem to quite fit into that which was recognized and understood by the mainstream of psychology. And so we were both kind of fiddling around on the paranormal. This is kind of like our hobby, because each of us was sort of pursuing more legitimate academic interest. And in fact, Christopher was was really well on his way to becoming an outstanding psychologist. He had, while he was a graduate student at the University of Waterloo, he had written a paper addressed to Walter Mischel, who was one of the outstanding personality theorists of the day, and was quite famous. And Chris wrote a critique of some of Michelle's work, and Michelle got back to Chris's thesis advisor after he'd read Chris's paper and said, this guy is a really outstanding student. That was a very, even though it was critical of his work, he thought it was a very interesting piece of work. So there he was going along and, working very hard, and he was going to get his PhD and become a clinical psychologist. And then, because of his interest in the self, and also because of his interest in the paranormal, another graduate student mentioned this book that he should read by P.D. Uspensky called In Search of the Miraculous, because this book dealt with the self and self-perception, and also dealt with the paranormal and with consciousness. And I would say at that point, like, even the idea that it dealt with consciousness probably didn't really resonate too much with Chris, because I don't even think at that point, like, consciousness was really a topic that he would say was foremost in his interest in psychology. He was really focused on self-perception and how to get people to change their perceptions of themselves as a therapist, which is what he was training to do. So he began reading this book and learned about G.I. Gurdjieff and the Fourth Way, because In Search of the Miraculous is Uspensky's account of the years, I think from 1915 to, I'm going to guess, about 1919, maybe 1920, during which he was living in Russia before the revolution, and had met Gurdjieff, who was a mystic and master who had traveled and widely in the East and had studied, and had established himself in Moscow as a teacher of a system of a mystical and esoteric system. And Uspensky had an interest in these topics and had traveled widely himself in search of a teacher, and then had kind of stumbled upon Gurdjieff in Moscow in, I believe, 1915. Anyway, In Search of the Miraculous is an account of Uspensky's years in Russia with Gurdjieff, and is in part it's a portrait of Gurdjieff, but mainly it's a presentation of the ideas that Gurdjieff was teaching in the form that he was teaching him in those days, and that's important. I'll explain that later, but it articulates the Fourth Way system, and which is an ancient esoteric teaching which Gurdjieff claimed to have discovered. Now, Gurdjieff says that this teaching was thousands of years old, but had disappeared for thousands of years, and that he had rediscovered it in his travels and his studies, and had updated it in a sense and to bring it to the modern times, but especially to the West. I mean, Gurdjieff was himself much more comfortable and familiar with the East, but it ended up that his work involved presenting his teaching to Westerners. Now, so Chris started reading this book, and Gurdjieff's focus in Search of the Miraculous is primarily on the overriding concern is, what is the nature of consciousness? And Christopher was just completely knocked out by as he began to read this material, because he realized that this is something that does not exist in modern psychology. This is completely unparalleled in modern psychology. And the more he began to study it, the more he realized, geez, this is so important. I'm going to do my doctoral thesis on this. He hadn't actually picked a topic yet, so he began to study the system, and he began to write his thesis, and he began to articulate these ideas of consciousness directly from his reading of In Search of the Miraculous and other books that he began to read about Gurdjieff and the Fourth Way. So as he was doing this, at the time Christopher was married, and he and his wife had separated, and his wife was living back in Ottawa, which is where I was. And so he used to come and visit his daughter every couple of weeks. He'd come to Ottawa to visit his daughter, Allison, and he would come up, and each trip he would come, he would bring me his latest version of his of the beginnings of his doctoral dissertation. And so he would be adding material every couple of weeks, and he was writing at a really astonishing pace. I couldn't believe how much he was able to add each time. And so that's how I began to... That was my introduction to the Fourth Way into G.I. Gurdjieff. And at the time, I didn't have a thesis topic either, and I thought, gee, you know, this is so much more interesting and so much more real than anything that I found in psychology. I was on the verge of dropping out of graduate school because I had real misgivings about the whole nature of the Western academic psychological enterprise. I think that I thought at the time that it really was largely trivial, and that the experimental approach was really much ado about nothing. That there were all sorts of there's an extraordinary amount of energy put into an undertaking that really didn't produce all that much in terms of real psychological knowledge. And I can remember just in reading the first few drafts of Christopher's thesis that, my God, this is unbelievable material. There's nothing like this, and there's nothing like this in Western psychology. And this is the key to a lot of questions that I have about things. First and foremost, what Gurdjieff said about consciousness, which really completely captured both Chris and I in terms of its profound nature, was his statement that our normal waking consciousness should be understood to be a state of waking sleep. And by that he didn't mean sleep in the literal sense, but what he meant was that we live in a state of associative semi-hypnotic existence in which everything happens mechanically. Gurdjieff actually says that everything happens, and it happens mechanically, just as rain falls due to changes in the atmosphere. So our mental and emotional and physical lives are governed by mechanical associations. And he also said that because everything happens, and that because we live in the state of waking sleep, that we labor under a series of psychological illusions. And amongst the most important of these illusions is the idea that we exist as one unified being, that we have what he called an I, a capital I. He said, really, the situation is quite diametrically opposed to this idea that the big I that we think that we have and that exists and endures consistently, is really only an abstraction, and that the only I that we have that exists continuously is our physical I, in the sense that we have a continuous physical existence. But rather, we should understand that we really consist of a bunch of little I's, and that there's different groups of I's. Some are stronger than others, so it give us the illusion of a sense of continuity of our identity. But really, if we start to observe ourselves, we have all these little different I's, many of which are quite antagonistic to others, and many of which lead quite separate lives from one another. So, for instance, the I that goes to bed at night with the aim of getting up in the morning and going jogging or exercising really isn't around when the alarm goes off in the morning and isn't there when one wants to smoke cigarettes in the afternoon. And if you start to observe yourself, you'll see in yourself, he says, that there really throughout the one's day, there's this continuous parade of eyes. There's these eyes that are charming and good-natured and good-willed, and then there's these other eyes that are petty and mean-spirited and cantankerous. And really, like, if you begin to observe yourself, you'll see that there's this procession through the day that he says, man's name is legion, and that rather than one eye, we are many eyes. And then the other thing he says is that because everything happens, we really can't do that, that the idea that we have will and that we do things is really quite illusory. So, now, what really struck me about this is that a couple of things that really appealed to me about this was, first of all, I had this idea I had recognized this, the idea of these multiple eyes in myself, but I had never really read anything in psychology which could integrate them for me. And so that really struck me. But mostly what really appealed to both Chris and I was that Gurdjieff said, like, this was, his teaching wasn't really a path of faith. It was a spiritual teaching, but it was not really a path of faith, but it was a path of understanding. And so rather than taking his word for any of this, that you had to study yourself, and you had to study yourself in terms of a system and verify for yourself what he was saying. And as scientists, this really appealed to Christopher and I, that, you know, I'm not just going to believe this because some teacher says it. I'm going to find this out for myself. And the other part of it was that he was saying that this is really quite extraordinary, is that you can verify all these things that I'm saying, but you have to do it in a certain way. You have to study yourself. You have to observe yourself. And you have to observe yourself not just haphazardly or any old way that you please, but systematically. So you have to study my system, and then you have to apply the teaching to your own observations of yourself. So really you're generating the data from your own self-observation, which either will affirm or contradict what's being said in the teaching. So as scientists, both Chris and I really, really thought that this was, you know, this was very appealing. And I think the really strange thing was that in no time at all, I began to observe myself, as did Christopher. We both began to observe ourselves, and I was very quickly convinced from observing myself that I was asleep and that I was laboring under these psychological illusions. I saw that how things happened. I saw that I was a machine, and that, as Gurdjieff said, I was really a mechanism to whom everything happened. And I saw how I couldn't do. And mostly, I saw how there was no real permanent I, that I consisted of all these different personages within myself. And Gurdjieff says at one point, when you begin to observe the multiplicity of eyes within yourself, there's no longer any need to go to the cinema. And really, that captures sort of the incredible richness as you start to observe, self-observe, of what you will discover just by paying attention throughout the day as to how you can be so many different people in the course of one day. And most of all, I saw how, like Gurdjieff says, that in our state of waking sleep, where we're not properly conscious and where we can't do things, we're essentially in prison. And I thought I saw how I was in prison. And at the same time, I think that... I mean, clearly Christopher was thinking along the same lines and was actually out ahead of me in terms of, because he was just so actively involved in this material. But we would get together and we would compare notes about what we'd understood about different ideas. And this was an ongoing process for about a year while he worked on developing his thesis. And we just thought that, we just came to the conclusion that this material, that the more that we studied it, the more convinced we became that the fourth way was really light years beyond anything that we knew of in modern psychology or philosophy, and that these ideas about the nature of consciousness, and these are very, this is just the beginning of Gurdjieff's teaching, but this whole idea that we're asleep and that we're not properly conscious and that we don't have a unified eye, and that we're beings that, to whom things happen, and that we can't do, we're so radically different from anything that we've discovered in modern psychology. And it just, adopting that framework just opened so many doors to us, and just gave us such an extraordinarily different understanding of the nature of the self, which is what we were both really interested in academically. And the other thing that, so as we compared notes, we just became more and more convinced that this is really, really profound, and that we had to understand what the nature of consciousness was. And now, having gone into psychology, I thought that that's basically what psychology was going to teach me, what the nature of consciousness was. But really, within academic Western psychology, this is in 1975, 76, consciousness had basically been banished with the advent of behaviorism in the 20s, and there was very little being done in terms of the study of consciousness. It was only at that point that really through the works of some pioneers such as Charles Tart and Robert Ornstein and Arthur Dyckman and a few other people, had begun in academic psychology to be a rediscovery of consciousness. And this kind of came out of, there was a succession after the humanistic revolution, Abraham Maslow and Rogers, Carl Rogers, people like that, had sort of led to these people like Tart exploring consciousness and incorporating ideas from mystical and esoteric traditions, and that was called the so-called transpersonal psychology movement. But really, that transpersonal psychology is very marginal within academic psychology. Pretty much nobody within academic psychology was interested in consciousness, and so it's completely easy and completely natural to get a PhD in psychology without knowing anything about consciousness. And by contrast, this is what we found was so extraordinary, is that you have to understand consciousness to understand psychology, and this is what Gurdjieff was pointing out to us. At one point, he was talking with Uspensky about consciousness, and Uspensky said, well, this is in 1915, but it was really, things hadn't changed by 1975, but Uspensky's statement sort of applies. He said the view is that amongst philosophers and psychologists is that consciousness is indefinable. And Gurdjieff said, oh, I disagree. He said, all this is rubbish. This is the usual scientific sophistry. And he says, the one thing that you have to understand is that you can know consciousness only in yourself. Observe that I say that you can know, for you can know it only when you have it. And when you have not got it, you can know that you have not got it, not at that very moment, but afterwards. Now, that's a bit complicated, but what he's saying, okay, you can know consciousness, but you can only know it in yourself. And you can only know it when you have it. But when you don't have it, you'll realize later that there have been moments when you weren't conscious, but you won't know them when you're not conscious because you're not conscious. You'll know them later. So he goes on, he says, I mean to say that when it comes again, meaning consciousness, you can see that it's been absent for a long time, and you can find or remember the moment when it disappeared and when it reappeared. You can also define the moments when you are nearer to consciousness and further away from consciousness. But by observing in yourself the appearance and the disappearance of consciousness, you will inevitably see one fact which you neither see nor acknowledge now, and that is that moments of consciousness are very short and are separated by long intervals of completely unconscious mechanical working of the machine. You will see that you can think, feel, act, speak, work without being conscious of it. And if you learn to see in yourselves the moments of consciousness and the long periods of mechanicalness, you will infallibly see in other people when they are conscious of what they're doing and when they are not. Now, self-observation, by observing myself, I came to believe that I this is entirely true. I could see how I could think and I could act and I could speak and I could work without being conscious of it. And at the same time, how really, if you, the more you observe yourself, the more you'll see that there are really moments of consciousness are quite infrequent and very short, and that really that this is the norm, and that's an extraordinary shock to discover this. Is that we think that when we're awake, and that we're conscious, aware beings who go about our day, but really, that's. Completely misrepresents the nature of our psychological existence, because most of the time we're asleep. Now, we've all had moments when, let's say, we're walking along and we're thinking about something, and we're kind of really engrossed in this thinking about something, and we walk, and then suddenly we come to and we realize, God, I just walked 3 or 4 blocks and I have absolutely no idea as to what was going on, and I was thinking about this thing. So we're on automatic pilot. I mean, all of us do that driving at some time. We've all had that experience of we'll be driving along, and it's just like, boy, how long have I been driving on automatic pilot? Well, Gurdjieff is saying that really that most of our waking, so-called waking existence consists of just that we're on automatic pilot in varying degrees all the time. And that really there are only very brief moments when something shocks us or something immobilizes us, and we wake up momentarily and we realize we can have the realization in that moment that, oh, I've been asleep and now I'm awake. And that reality really escapes you until you try to observe yourself systematically, because you take it for granted that you're awake, but that was a great shock that Christopher and I discovered through self-observation. And so, oh, you know, this is right, that most of the time we really are asleep, and that if you try to be conscious, if you try to be aware, then there are moments when you come to and you'll realize that, oh, you know, I've been out of it for the last, you know, half an hour or whatever. And if you really sort of investigate it, you can realize the moment when you lost consciousness. Uspensky describes in Search of the Miraculous how he had been walking along the street and he had been trying to be aware of himself. And then he went in and he purchased cigarettes, and then he went and he purchased stationery, and then he went home and he wrote several letters. And about 2 hours later, he woke up and he realized that he had, ever since that moment when he'd been walking along the street, he'd essentially been asleep. And that's what self-observation on a regular basis begins to reveal to you. And there's absolutely no way of overestimating the importance of this. This is something that has completely escaped Western psychology and philosophy, is that we don't remember ourselves. And that's the other aspect of another fundamental idea in Gurdjieff's system, is he says you have to observe yourself, but at the same time you have to try to remember yourself. Now, this is a very complicated topic, but he talks about the process of self-remembering. And really, the concept of self-remembering, your understanding, it, the more you do it, the more your understanding of it evolves, and so you get a very different sense of it. But in its most basic sense, Gurdjieff says you have to try to remember yourself. And by that, he means you have to try to be present in such a way that basically you're just holding the experience, just trying to be aware, I am here in this moment. And what you try to do is don't try to think it, you just try to feel it and be aware of it. And so he prescribes that in addition to observing yourself, the way to awaken is to try to remember yourself. And this is much, much, much more difficult than it would seem. And Uspensky relates that he had been teaching a group in Moscow, and they had all been told to try to remember themselves, try to be aware, I am here in different situations, in different moments. And so at a meeting of his pupils, Gurdjieff said, well, what did you observe when you tried to remember yourself? And different people gave different explanations, and he wasn't very satisfied with them. He said that really nobody had realized the most obvious and important thing about self-remembering. And he said, not one of you has noticed the most important thing that I pointed out to you. That is to say, not one of you has noticed that you do not remember yourselves. He gave particular emphasis to these words. You do not feel yourselves. You are not conscious of yourselves. With you, quote, it observes, quote, just as it speaks, it thinks, it laughs. You do not feel. I observe. I notice. I see. Everything is still noticed, is still seen. So he says, in order to observe oneself, one must first of all remember oneself. And then again, he gave particular emphasis to these words. And he says, try to remember yourselves when you observe yourselves, and later on tell me the results. Only those results will have any value that are accompanied by self-remembering. Otherwise, you yourselves do not exist in your observations, in which case, what are all your observations worth? Now, this is really, it's a bit difficult to convey this without allowing people to take the opportunity to try to do this, but if you try to observe yourself systematically, and at the same time, you're trying to remember yourself, you're trying to be aware of yourself, and be more present to yourself, you'll find that first of all, a number of things, I feel like I'm kind of trying to get to the essence of this, and I'm talking around it, but in a sense, the most essential thing that you'll find out is that if you try to remember yourself, most of the time you won't be able to remember yourself. That's the most important thing. I mean, Christopher and I, when we began doing this, we were so excited by this idea that, self-remembering, this is so important. And we try to remember and we try to remind one another, to remember ourselves. But you can go through an entire day and not remember yourself at all. Even when you're trying to remember yourself, it's very, very difficult to remember to remember. Then, of course, in those moments when you do remember yourself and you're relatively more aware of your circumstances and of yourself being here now, what happens is that very quickly that passes and your attention becomes engaged and you become either absorbed or embedded. Those are Christopher's terms, in whatever captures your attention. And all of a sudden, you've forgotten to remember yourself. And so you can be engaged in a conversation or engaged in doing an activity or engaged in having some sort of emotional feelings about something or some combination of all three, and you'll completely forget that your objective to remember yourself. You'll be, again, in a state of sleep, and some time may pass, and then all of a sudden you remember, I'm supposed to remember myself, and so you start again. So you try to do that. And what you'll find from that is that, well, first of all, it's kind of maddening because it should be simple, but it isn't. It's quite difficult to do. And the second thing is that the other side of it is that as you try to remember yourself and as you do this more often, there starts to become a very subtle difference in your experience. And in a sense, everything becomes more vivid. Everything becomes more alive. And you start to connect those moments in which you have been able to come to, and you start to have a very different sense of yourself. And that's what you're striving to do, is you're trying to get over all your habitual sources of sleep and trying to wake up. And this is what Gurdjieff's entire objective was. He was trying to present a method to people to awaken from sleep and to know themselves. And, of course, by knowing themselves, he didn't mean knowing their superficial, usual selves, but rather to cut through all the illusions and all the misunderstandings and all falseness with which people misrepresent themselves to themselves, to know the true self, which underlies the false self that is imposed through our conditioning and our acculturation and our education and just being in life amongst sleepwalkers. So this idea that we can awaken from this is premised on the idea that we have to observe ourselves and that we have to remember ourselves. Now, self-observation is particularly important in this sense because it provides the methodology to organize observations of oneself. And so you're always looking at a particular activity when you're self-observing. You're trying to understand some aspect of your intellectual or your emotional or your physical or your sexual functioning. And you're trying to understand the circumstances that which lead to your experience, and you're trying to understand the experience in the sense that it's a mechanical experience. You're trying to understand how things happen to you. And one of the things that Gurdjieff says is, like, people are incredibly complex machines, and they're machines that operate very badly because they've been very badly maintained. And the idea is that, first of all, if you're going to fix the machine, you have to understand its parts. Secondly, you have to understand how it functions and how it doesn't function properly. And so that's what self-observation is intended to do. And as a result of that this leads, in terms of Gurdjieff's teaching, this led Christopher and I to begin to understand, okay, yeah, this is the way to study consciousness. You can't, if you're going to study consciousness as modern psychologists do once they began to recognize that consciousness existed, if you're going to try to understand it by studying other people's brains and by studying it in other people, you're not really going to understand the most important thing about consciousness, which is that our normal waking state of consciousness is not a state of proper consciousness. I mean, part of the problem is that pretty much everybody in modern psychology subscribes to a very simplistic formula of consciousness, and that is that there are two states, essentially, that psychologists recognize about consciousness. One, when we're asleep, and two, when we're awake. But that really misses out on Gurdjieff says there are two other fundamental states. There's the state of self-consciousness, and there's the state of objective consciousness. Now, self-consciousness is a state in which you remember yourself, so that you're in a state of self-conscious awareness. And Gurdjieff says that this is the rightful possession of human beings, but that they've lost this. And he has a very complex explanation as to how this has happened. But he said that really, this is the way that people should function psychologically properly. They should be able to remember themselves. They should be able to be self-consciously aware all the time at will. And if they were, then their way of knowing and understanding both themselves and the world would be fundamentally and radically reconstituted and changed. And then beyond self-consciousness, beyond the higher, which is the third state, is the fourth state of objective consciousness. In the third state of self-consciousness, Gurdjieff says if you were to really acquire a state of self-consciousness, you would be a self-conscious awareness, you would know the truth about yourself. And in the fourth state, which is objective consciousness, you'd know the truth about the universe. Now, he's saying that there's a possibility for human beings to realize this objective state of consciousness, and that really in that state, that is the key to obtaining objective knowledge of oneself and the universe is to develop consciousness. It's not to know things. He says in the normal waking state of consciousness, there are limits to what you can know, which are inherent to that state of consciousness. However, if you develop a state of self-conscious awareness, you'll get a more objective understanding of the nature of yourself. And if you further develop consciousness, you can attain objective consciousness and know the universe. Now, that's a radically different ontological in terms of the nature of being and epistemological in terms of the nature of how we know formulation of what it means to be human. And in a sense, it's like, you know, when Krista and I started studying the fourth way, it's a little bit disconcerting to study yourself and come to admit that you're a hapless automaton who's buffeted about by forces that he can't control and can't recognize. And it's a bit of a downer, you know, to think that you're a zombie walking around in a state of waking sleep. But the other side of it is that. The scenario that Gurdjieff presents is that, well, if you were able to awake, if you were able to escape the imprisonment of sleep, you would be able to know yourself, not your superficial self, but to truly know the nature of your being, which is an extraordinarily exciting and inspiring promise. And then, of course, beyond that, it's possible to know the universe if you attain objective consciousness. Now, the likelihood of that happening isn't all that great, according to his formulation and according to my experience of efforts to awaken. But at the same time, the really wonderful thing, and this is what was so incredibly exciting for Chris and I in the first years that we studied this material, the wonderful thing is that even the slightest effort to try to know yourself, to try to work to observe yourself, to try to remember yourself, to come to even slightly for brief periods of time, is that it changes the meaning of everything. It changes the one's sense of who one is, and changes one's sense of what it possibly might mean to be human. It changes one's sense of what it means to be alive on this planet and interacting with other people and being a part of this earth. It's an extraordinarily exciting and promising vista that opens up in terms of how much you work at and how hard you work at doing this, and in that sense, I think that really Chris and I were very fortunate in the sense that we were able to carry on a continuous dialogue in the first couple of years that we studied this material. And we tried to interest our colleagues and other graduate students, professors in this material, and other than for one or two exceptions, nobody seemed to see anything of value in it. And we were quite shocked by this, because the more we studied the fourth way, the more we realized, oh my God, this is material that is just of another order of meaning, and this is so important. And everybody else kind of said, no, they didn't really see it. And part of the problem that we felt was, first of all, Uspensky says something very interesting about people who are attracted to esoteric and mystical ideas. And he says that to be interested in, he was speaking particularly the fourth way when he said this, but I think this applies in general to all esoteric teachings. He said that to be drawn to this material, you have to have a certain dissatisfaction with the existing explanations of things. And I think that as much as Chris and I were scholars and were very excited and interested to be studying psychology, both of us had kind of reached the conclusion from our studies that there was something really essential lacking in modern psychology. And Christopher had studied philosophy quite extensively. He was very involved in studying existentialism for several years when he was an undergraduate. And each of us had been able to glean certain things in these different systems that we'd studied and different philosophical and psychological ideas, but we always kind of thought that there was something missing. And one of the things that really convinced us of that was that we believed that there was something beyond the explanations of in the existence of the paranormal. There was a whole field that seemed to be outside the scope of explanation of modern psychology and science, and we didn't dismiss it as being imaginary or being a matter of self-deception or illusion. We thought that these were realities that needed to be explained, and so in part that was part of our dissatisfaction. But as soon as we began to be aware of the idea that consciousness was something that needed to be explained, which is directly in contradiction to our psychological training, we both agreed that this really exposed the big lie of psychology. And at the same time, it sort of addressed what we had suspected all the time, that there was some sort of missing link, and that we saw that in the study of consciousness and in the systematic study of consciousness, that this is going to provide the key to understanding everything in an entirely new light. And the more we studied, the more we felt that. And the more we compared notes, the more we were convinced. Some people would say perhaps that this is the case of folie à deux, that there were two guys who were kind of taking things to some sort of extraordinary level of self-deception and illusion. But we knew that wasn't true, and even though we couldn't seem to convince anybody else, we kind of felt more and more that looking at things through the perspective of the fourth way, we began to see how much of what passed for knowledge and what passed for explanations of things was really a case of the emperor wearing no clothes, and that it was all. It was all a sort of a tissue of fabrications and lies and misstatements and bad assumptions and just really didn't have anything substantial to it. When I say it, I mean psychological knowledge, and we really saw that at the very least, the fourth way was providing a perspective which would allow us to ask questions that needed to be asked, specifically about the nature of consciousness, but about everything, about personality structure and about the nature of the self, and about the nature of self-perception, and about what really constitutes proper psychological research. Now, as graduate students, you know, you're not supposed to study yourself when you're when you're in psychology. You're supposed to study others. You're supposed to study rats and undergraduates and chimpanzees and rats and, dolphins and rats and rats and more rats. But you never study yourself. And that's the more we studied ourselves in terms of the fourth way, the more we realize that that is completely that's a huge mistake in modern psychology, is that psychologists don't want to study themselves. They want to study others, and then they don't want to study consciousness in themselves. They want to study it by studying other people's brains. And so that we really began to realize that this is a fundamentally different methodology for the study of psychology, and that we felt that this was undoubtedly much more promising than anything that existed in modern psychology. Now, one of the things about trying to remember yourself and trying to observe yourself, which really sort of rang true for me, is that there's a great social psychologist by the name of Kurt Lewin, who came to prominence during the 30s and the 40s, and in studying social psychology, he had a very wonderful statement. He said that in order to really understand something, the best way to study it was to introduce a change into it. Now, that's precisely what you're doing in terms of studying consciousness when you try to remember yourself and when you try to observe yourself. You're making a change in that which you want to study. And see, in a way, that's the problem with so much of psychologists' approach to it, is that they never study themselves, so they never really introduce a change other than they never really introduce a change in consciousness. And when they're studying brain processes, they're just really watching some sort of really minuscule, tiny little part of the brain, and they're trying to extrapolate from that observation of some really isolated process, and they're trying to make a global statement about consciousness. But consciousness itself is never really addressed in that approach. What you have is you have an aspect of consciousness. You have a process, a neurochemical, biological process that you're describing, but you're not really talking about consciousness. And really, that's just, as the more we studied the system, the fourth way system, the more we came to realize, well, that's completely missing the boat. You have to study yourself and you have to study yourself systematically. You can't just sort of do it willy-nilly, that you have to have a teaching. And that's precisely what Gurdjieff had said. And he said, one thing he said about self-remembering, which I think is, was really important, is that when you try to remember yourself and you can't, you might get frustrated, but in a way, you're frustrated by the fact that you can't remember yourself, but in a way, to understand that through your efforts that you've tried to remember yourself, that you can't, that's a very important realization. He says, most people don't understand that. And if you don't understand it, you can't really understand the most basic fact about the psychology of consciousness, which is you do not remember yourself. And so that was, the beginnings of, for Christopher and I, that was the beginnings, and that was just a very small slice of what we were exposed to when we began to study the fourth way. One of the ideas that, in terms of organizing the observations of yourself, one of the ideas that really, I think, became very profound for Christopher and I, and which to this day is still resonating with us, and I think if you look at Christopher's work, you'll see a definite progression in his understanding of the nature of consciousness based on the idea of that we are multi-brain beings and multi-dimensional beings. I'm just going to take a drink of water here because I'm losing my voice. Now, in Gurdjieff's system, Gurdjieff says that in modern psychology, we talk about, in terms of dualities, the mind and the body, the mind and behavior. Psychology is defined as the science of the mind and the behavior. In Gurdjieff's system, he says that we should be understood to be that man in his normal state, human beings in their normal state, are three-brain beings, and that a completed human being, that is a human being who has evolved and has acquired all of his or her faculties of consciousness, is a seven-brain being. Now, the idea is that of the centers, he talks about that we have seven centers of intelligence, or seven brains. And the most fundamental aspects of these brains or centers is that, well, one, they each have their own way of knowing. Two, they each have their own speed of operation. Three, they each have their own particular form of memory. And four, they each have a center of gravity in a different part of the body. Now, each of the centers is said to be distributed throughout the entire body, but it actually has a locus of concentration. So, in terms of understanding the centers, he says that we have a head brain, which is centered in the head, and which he calls the intellectual center. And it does all the basic intellectual tasks, such as thinking and reasoning and comparing, predicting and abstracting, that kind of thing. Then he says we have an emotional center, which is located in the complexes of the nerve complexes, like the cardiac and the nerve plexus of the abdomen is what I'm trying to say, the solar and the cardiac plexus, and the sympathetic nervous system. And the emotional center registers and processes impressions in terms of appetite of dimensions such as likes and dislikes and pleasantness and unpleasantness, etc. So our emotional center is in the abdomen. It's in the heart, and it's in the gastric, and it's in the solar plexus. And then there's the moving center. And the moving center is responsible for all learned movement and is centered in the spinal column. And then you have the instinctual center, which governs all of the body's innate functions and the metabolic and sensory processes. And it's located in the lower structures of the brainstem and in the spinal column. And then there's the sexual center, which is located in the sexual organs. And then, in addition to those, so there's five lower centers. But Gurdjieff says that typically human beings in waking sleep can be understood as three brain beings. So we function intellectually, emotionally, and physically. And in the physical, really, is the moving, instinctual, and sexual centers typically operate in concert and so closely that he says that in terms of understanding them on certain levels, it's best just to think in terms of us being a three-brain being in our normal waking state of consciousness or state of waking sleep. Then he says there's two higher centers. There's the higher emotional center and there's a higher intellectual center. And that in these, that's where the faculties of higher consciousness exist, and that we can develop these higher faculties. But he doesn't really say all that much about the nature of these higher faculties. Yastrzemski says that in a sense it's like a blind person trying to speak about colors, because it's something that's so far beyond our typical experience and our ability to conceptualize that we can't really talk about these higher centers. But that the important point for Gurdjieff too is two points. Or one is that these centers already exist fully developed within us, and two, that we can become conscious in them and can begin to apprehend reality through the actions of these centers. The problem is that in a normal human being, quote unquote, these lower centers don't function harmoniously. They don't do the work that they're intended to do, and they're imbalanced and aren't coordinated and aren't harmonious. And so, because of that, we can't make connections with our higher centers. Gurdjieff says if we brought our lower centers into balance and if they did the work that they should properly do, then we'd be able to develop connections with our higher centers, and we'd be able to acquire the faculties of higher consciousness. So there, in terms of, again, when Chris and I started to study this idea of people being multi-brain beings, we were, I know for me, one of the things that had always bothered me in psychology was that in discussing the nature of intelligence, I thought that really, psychologists adhere to a rather, this is 1975, 76, really a restricted understanding of the nature of intelligence, and they put way too much emphasis on cognition and the head brain, and not enough on other aspects of intelligence. Now, in the 30 years since then, there's been a much broader understanding of the multidimensional nature of intelligence, but But at that time, especially, this really struck me as this idea. So, okay, you know, we have these different brains, and that we had different, that they had different locuses of concentration in the body. I thought that this was an extraordinarily important idea. And in addition to this, Gurdjieff says that, you know, people can be differentiated in terms of how they're typically centered. So he calls them man number one, number two, and number three. And man number one is centered typically in a moving center, not somebody who's perhaps an athlete or who's a person who really enjoys physical labor and physical activity. So they're more typically centered in their moving instinctual center, their physical center. Man number two is an emotional center, and that's people who respond more to things through their likes and their dislikes and through their sensitivities and less through cognition and more through feeling. And then man number three is somebody who's more of an intellectual type and is typically registers impressions more predominantly in terms of thought and abstractions. And so now everybody in their life will have different experiences where they're centered in different ways, but we all have to fall into one of these three categories generally, he says, in terms of how we are more typically oriented. And one of the things that self-observation reveals is that, first of all, typically when we are centered in a center, we're not conscious in that center. We're not very aware of ourselves. And also to have ourselves interact through the three centers at the same time and to be conscious in all three centers at the same time is very, very difficult. That's what truly, that's a higher kind of understanding of what self-remembering means, is that if we were to truly remember ourselves, then we would be conscious in our thinking center and using our thinking center to think, conscious in our emotional center and using our emotional center to feel, and conscious in our physical center and having our physical center do what it's supposed to do. What Gurdjieff says is that the problem, one of the biggest problems in terms of the biggest obstacles to developing consciousness, is that typically we're centered, our centers operate in ways that they're not intended to operate, and he calls this wrong work. And he said each center has its own sort of distinctive styles of doing things that are not, it's not intended to do. But in addition to these various processes, which he names, he also says that the other class of wrong work, which characterizes all the centers, is that they work for each other. So in cases where the thinking center really should be thinking, it's feeling. And when the feeling center should be feeling, it's thinking. And this kind of substitution of one center for the other goes on all the time. And he says, in fact, that's what a neurotic is that somebody in whom the centers are acting improperly. Now, he goes through a variety of different classes of wrong work, and I can't really get into all the details, but he talks about, for instance, in the intellectual center, that we lie when we talk about things that we don't know. And in the emotional center, the emotional center's wrong work is very, very important. He talks about identification, that we're always attached or absorbed or embedded emotionally in whatever captures our attention. So we're identified. And he says identification is the chief obstacle to self-remembering, because you, when you are invested in something, you can't have the separate sense of I am here. You can't remember your I. You can't feel your presence in the proper way because you're so invested or emotionally attached to something. In addition to identification, he also talks about negative emotions, and he says negative emotions are one of the major obstacles to the development of consciousness, and because they're so prevalent and they're so pervasive, and when you start talking about negative emotions and you start naming them, you realize just the sheer number of names for negative emotions is an indication of how much they rule our lives and how much they deprive us of energy and how much they stand in the way of us experiencing ourselves being here now. And that's one of the major classes of negative emotions, one of the major classes of wrong work which stands in the way of developing consciousness and awareness. And in the physical center, he also mentions that we have all sorts of habitual muscular habitual postures and habitual muscular tensions and a variety of processes which various types of body work try to address, and which anybody who's ever tried to do anything from yoga to any kind of martial arts, you realize that really our consciousness and our body is very, very underdeveloped, and that there are a variety of ways of developing this consciousness. But he says in general, the bigger problem is that we don't understand how our emotional and our intellectual and our physical centers are in such intimate contact with one another, and that they depend on one another, and they result from one another, so that if you start thinking in a certain way, you'll have a corresponding emotional feeling, and you'll have corresponding physical postures and physical tensions that will accompany that thought, and vice versa. If you fall into certain physical states, it'll generate certain emotional and cognitive processes. And he says, the problem is, in terms of developing consciousness, this is an incredible barrier to the development of consciousness, because in order to try to develop consciousness in each of our centers of intelligence, of the three lower centers, we run into this problem that we can't keep watch over the entirety of our being, that it's too complicated. And this is where a teacher comes in. A teacher is one who is able to identify, first of all, what the nature of the problems are, and Gurdjieff was particularly adept at doing this, is identifying that the essential problems that his various pupils faced, and people differed quite radically in terms of the obstacles of consciousness, and that by keeping watch over the entirety of the person, the teacher can actually perform that observing function, and can perform supervisory function to direct the energy that the pupil needs to direct towards the processes that need to be identified and worked on. And there are all sorts of different ways of doing this in terms of teaching, and as I say, Gurdjieff was particularly adept at doing this. But anybody who studies themselves and tries to make efforts to awaken runs into this obstacle, and this is something that through our discussions, Chris and I realized, boy, it's really, really, you're facing long odds if you think that you're going to be able to awaken from this waking sleep. I mean, there's nothing very optimistic about this perspective, and that may be, in fact, why some people are not at all attracted to it. But as I say, the other side of it all is that even the rewards of even the slightest efforts are extraordinary and really are quite inspiring. So that's what kept us pushing on and trying to learn more and more, and to try to study ourselves and to try to work on ourselves and to try to help one another by challenging one another in terms of, like, well, you're asleep and try to wake up. Now, the problem with all that, of course, is that really only goes so far, because you have to have a much more sophisticated knowledge of the nature of being and the nature of consciousness in order to really provide the necessary guidance and supervision to help somebody awaken. And I think that in the case of both Chris and myself, over the years, as much as we made these efforts and worked together and worked with other people, we've never really had somebody who is a real teacher. And I think that's, in terms of Gurdjieff's system, he's very emphatic about that, about the need for a teacher and the need for an organization, and that I would say is probably the thing that's been most missing in our lives in terms of we've certainly met a lot of individuals who are teachers in their own ways, but we've never really had a teacher who we identified as our teacher and who accepted us as students. But anyway, I'm realizing I'm rambling on here, and we're getting on to quarter to the hour. That was the beginnings of this long journey, as I say, that Christopher Holmes has taken, and those are just a couple of the basic elements that we began with. But I can't, even 30 years later, this idea of trying to remember yourself is just so incredibly useful and extraordinary in terms of changing the meaning of your understanding of everything and the meaning of everything. It's a process that you can do, and you should try to do all the time, is to try to wake up, is to try to remember yourself, is to try to gain a sense of your I am here. Gurdjieff said that one of the things that in a different period in his teaching, he said that it was very important to develop this sense every day to try to feel your I. And one of the things I think that Chris has developed in his later work through exposure to other teachings and through the development of what we spoke of earlier, through the development of the heart doctrine, is that he emphasizes that you should try to feel your sense of I in your heart, and especially in the upper right quadrant of your heart, and try to feel your sense that I just feel I. And this is the extraordinary nature of esotericism. That's like, I'm talking about something that on the surface sounds so simple, but in another way it's nothing simple about it at all. But it's also, the more you do it, the more you realize how incredibly profound and complex it is. And it really, modern psychology, with all of its equipment and its sophisticated computers and techniques for analyzing data, really can't approach the esotericism in terms of this most basic exercise and this most basic methodology for studying consciousness. You have to study consciousness in yourself. And the most basic way of doing it is to try to remember yourself, is to try to awaken. Now, as I say, 30 years later, I still find that this idea, then my understanding of, if you ask me now, what I understand of self-remembering, I could spend another 2 hours talking about that very easily. It really is so much more developed and so much deeper than it was when I first began doing this. But that's part of the magic of this whole journey, of this whole trip, is that as you study yourself and as you work on yourself to try to develop consciousness, and as you continue to read and discuss and have experiences with other people who share the same aims, you sense the magic of existence, and you sense the incredibly inspiring nature of what it means to be alive. I think that would be my predominant impression, is that nothing fills me with the wonder of being alive like that this most basic exercise. Sometimes when I'm kind of overwhelmed by my problems, or, you know, fretting about solving the material question, as Mr. Gurdjieff referred to making money, that all I do is stop and I try to remember that I am here, and to try to, in a sense, it's like self-remembering is to forget yourself too, is to forget all your troubles, forget all your worries, to let your physical tensions go. They'll be back, you know, don't worry about it, you can let them go. And to drop everything, to stop thinking, stop obsessing, stop, and forget all the normal constituents of yourself, and just remember, I am here. Try to feel that in your heart, try to feel your body, try to feel your breath, try to feel your pulse, and try to feel, I am here. Everything will become more vivid, and everything every atom of creation will be thrilled with the omniscience, as to paraphrase Madame Blavatsky, that there's a phrase that she uses about it, the absolute thrills through every atom of creation. I think I'm butchering that a little bit, but the idea is that it thrills. I love that. And in a sense, self-remembering resonates with that thrill, I think. I think that's one of the things that I've, over 30 years, that I've realized, is that it never loses its luster, it never loses its magic, it never loses its power, it never loses its capacity to inspire and to raise one out of life. There's, in Sufism, they talk about, something akin to self-remembering. I'm not sure exactly if they call it self-remembering, but Gurdjieff was very influenced by Sufism. But they talk about it as, they compare it to emerging from underwater and breathing the air. And I think that's a really apt metaphor, because it's like you emerge from one medium into a more rarefied medium, but at the same time, and then you inspire, you breathe in, and you exist in a completely different medium, and that's what self-remembering can lead to. And the other thing is that the more you do it, the more, as I said before, the more these processes are joined together, and you start to create a different sense of self, which is linked by those moments in which you were more aware and were more awake. I just mentioned again that go back to Christopher mention again that his website is www.zeropoint.ca, and if you go on there, you'll see that he has several books, and his website is really good. It provides a really good collection of excerpts from his writings, and will really give you an overview of what his work is about. Now, everything I talked about today is about, I think it's fundamental to Chris's work even now, which has taken on much more of a cosmological emphasis as he pursues the implications of Madame Blavatsky's masterwork, The Secret Doctrine. But at the same time, it's all really grounded in these ideas from Gurdjieff, too. Like, I mean, even though he's changed the emphasis over the years of his work, it starts with this idea that we're multi-brained, multi-dimensional beings. And I didn't really even touch on that idea of how we're multi-dimensional beings. But one of the things that Gurdjieff said, which I think that is sort of inspired Christopher and to pursue these other esoteric teachings and has really been fulfilled in his work, is this idea that the division between, in his teaching, there's a psychological component and there's a cosmological component, but he says really that division is arbitrary and is an artifact of our normal understanding of things. But once we really begin to know ourselves and the universe and the gods, then those distinctions really collapse, because we are multidimensional beings who are ultimately related to the absolute, and the journey of the trip is to proceed from an understanding and the study of oneself and the cosmos to the point where one understands oneself and the cosmos, and I think to a certain extent, as Chris and I were saying earlier, 30 years ago when we were beginning this undertaking, we were asking intelligent questions based on what we'd learned through Gurdjieff. But now, I think 30 years later, I think Chris's work definitely reveals that he has at least some tentative answers to a lot of these things. Well, I'd say they're more than tentative, but he has some pretty profound answers to these things, and at least a framework in which you can really understand how and in what way the mystical and esoteric teachings are describing the nature of reality. It's really a validation of those ideas, and he's able to translate these things into a framework which establishes a dialogue with modern psychology and science, which I think is really, really important. These ideas have always existed. They've existed for thousands of years in a variety of forms, but we live in an age which is dominated by science and technology. And it's in my mind really self-defeating and really serves nobody's purpose to not have a dialogue with science and to not try to understand these ideas in terms of what science is discovering, because it's really exciting to see the parallels that exist in these different viewpoints. I just wanted to say that when I was on a couple of weeks ago, I made a mistake when I referred to, I wanted to thank BBS Radio again and Donald and Doug Newsom. I think I referred to Don as Don Nelson, and at the time I had just heard Don Nelson, the NBA coach being interviewed on the radio, so I think I may have had a bit of response interference there, Don, so I apologize for that, but it is the Brothers Newsome, and we'd like to thank BBS Radio for giving us the forum to present Zero Point Radio, and for all the other people that appear on Zero Point. It's a wonderful service and provides a real alternative, which is much needed in these times of media domination by huge corporations that really want to present a very restricted presentation of what is going on this crazy planet. And I think the value of the topics that are and the people that present on BBS is a much needed antidote to the much of the baffle gab and lies and outright corruption that goes out over the airwaves. So thanks to Doug and Don, and thanks to BBS Radio. I should also mention that previous programs, I think there's a bit of a technical problem going on right now, but Don said that this would be addressed within the next couple of weeks. All the archives of the Zero Point broadcast, if you want to listen to previous broadcasts, please visit the archives. We haven't been doing our homework on that front, but Chris and I have intended to begin to try to provide some sort of a summary of what the different programs involve. We've been doing the show for, I don't know, about 18 months now, I think. I've sort of lost track of time here, but anyway, if you're interested, and if you want to hear different examinations of different topics and hear Christopher speak, I urge you to visit the BBS archives, which is it's really great that these programs, if you miss one, you can just go to the archives, and nobody's charging you anything too, which is even better. In conclusion, I'm not really sure exactly what I was going to say in conclusion, but just that, as I said at the beginning of the broadcast, I'm writing this book about Christopher's work, which is going to be at least two volumes now, and about two-thirds of the way through the first one. And I think that really his work stands as a very, very interesting counterpoint to the atheistic, mechanistic, reductionistic scientific viewpoint, and brings an entirely different perspective to what I would call the phony debate between science, the reality of science and religion. I think that much of what passes for intelligent discussion on this is anything but, and really by focusing on consciousness and trying to understand how consciousness determines how we know and how we can know, it leads to an entirely different understanding of the supposed antagonism between science and religion. I would say that there's nothing in science that disproves the real unity of religious ideals, that which underlies all religions, and that the ideas in religion are not only valid, but really have important things to say that scientists can incorporate, and which they should recognize as alternative ways of understanding the nature of reality, and that they should be a little bit more humble about what they know and what they don't know on the basis of that. And as I say, Christopher's examination of these issues is, I think, unparalleled in I don't know of anybody else, I'd say, in modern thought. I don't know of anybody else who really has his perspective on these topics, and I think he's a very important thinker. And if you've been listening this far, you probably are somewhat amenable to being convinced of that idea. So, as I say, I would urge you to visit the Zero Point website and check out his work. I think the Heart Doctrine is an extraordinary piece of work, and I think Chris's book, Man's Psychological Illusions, is a wonderful examination of Gurdjieff's teaching, and his latest work on God and the Secret Doctrine, Madame Blavatsky's work, is just, I'm in the process of helping him edit it, and hopefully it'll be out very soon. It's called God, Science, and the Secret Doctrine. And, again, another really wonderful and provocative examination of the nature of science and religion and how we can know things and how we don't know things. And it's definitely worth, if you have an interest in these topics, I would really urge you to visit his website to try to look at this. Don, how are we doing for time? I'm running out of time here.